This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
Welcome to the first episode of a new series from Urban Political, in collaboration with the Georg Simmel Center for Urban Studies at Humboldt University Berlin. This series will feature speakers from the center's Think and Drink Colloquium. The colloquium invites international speakers from across urban studies to present their work and offers an informal setting for exchange between students, faculty, and the general public. This first episode features a talk by Maroš Krivý, Associate Professor and Director of Urban Studies at the Faculty of Architecture at the Estonian Academy of Arts. In addition, he is currently a Marie Curie Fellow at the Canadian Center for Architecture in Montreal. And what we are about to hear is an outcome of his research during the last 2 years. His research focuses on architecture, urbanism, and the environment in the post-war and post-Cold War periods. And this talk, titled Valuing Indeterminacy, Terrain Vague, Temporary Use and the Production of Urban Expertise in Barcelona and Berlin, explores the histories of making indeterminacy into a desirable feature for cities. Now, thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy the talk.
So I'm really excited to be part of this colloquium with so many fantastic speakers in the past. And so today I want to share a snippet from an ongoing research project on the history of neoliberalism and urban expertise, in which I focus on a series of case studies drawn from European and North American cities to ask how nominally progressive planners, architects, and other experts accommodated post-industrial capital. And my main concern lies with the role of various theories and concepts these experts have generated in marginalizing inequality and exploitation concerns, urban policy and planning more broadly. And so this is a history of a kind of missed encounter between urban expertise and social justice across a range of fields, including urban wastelands and their transformation, which is the topic I'll engage today. And naturally, neoliberal urbanism has been if not the key theme in urban studies. And my contribution centers around a sociology of knowledge production or a kind of social history of ideas. As neoliberalism mutates into something even darker today, we can start revisiting its ideological work and assumptions through a kind of historical lens. So I want to open up these larger questions with two stories from Barcelona and Berlin, and two decades on either side of the millennium's turn. And so we'll do so by taking a closer look at the politics of urban wastelands. And there's now quickly expanding interdisciplinary literature on the transformation of tangibly empty, unplanned or residual urban land. And urban scholars have engaged in this context with post-industrial capitalism, emergent constellations of urban ecology, and various forms of socio-environmental injustice in their structural and experiential dimension. And I very much build on these literatures, even as my attention shifts to the fields of architecture and planning, marked by the interest in the categories of non-design and non-planning, and how they intersect with the dynamics of urbanized capital and the free market economy. And there is some emerging scholarship on this as well. So historically, narratives of wastelands and wilderness have been used by capitalist and colonial agents to label frontier territories as underdeveloped, in this way priming them for improvement, planification, intensification, and accumulation. So Neil Smith's classic work on the frontier imaginary, colonial expansion and intercity gentrification, or we can think about the historian Vittoria de Palma, for example, who in a beautiful and deeply researched history of wasteland showed that the wasteland category is above all a way of seeing or experiencing landscape marked by fear, disgust, and other negative emotions. While for the 17th century liberal philosopher John Locke, the argument that all land that hasn't been improved to its full potential through private property can be classified as a wasted land, and therefore also as a wasted opportunity, was key to how he justified enclosures in England and colonization of America, in which he had a personal stake. Yet my focus is on contemporary histories of architects, planners, and other urban experts giving the wasteland category of positive meaning, and how historically this has been a sort of double-edged sword, to the extent that even as these experts insisted on the intrinsic value of or sort of potentiality of disused industrial or infrastructure sites, they theorized this value in a sort of narrowly economistic or then abstractly philosophical terms that effectively prioritize the needs of post-industrial capital over those of existing communities, whether human or non-human. So lest this sound too speculative, let's straight jump into my two case studies. And we will spend the remainder of this talk in Barcelona and Berlin in the years around the millennium's turn. And so these two cases have several things in common. I will highlight three. One, these cities underwent a massive process of urban redevelopment. In the case of Barcelona, it is post-Franco, post-dictatorship urbanization program, turning into the Olympic Games urban development program in the early 1990s, marked by the Olympic Games in 1992. And in the case of Berlin, it is the post-reunification redevelopment marked by the critical reconstruction program and iconic projects led by private capital. So that's one thing these two cases have in common. And the second one that is that there are socialist or social democratic governments and leaders who challenged conservative forces or legacies in city planning while also embracing neoliberal forms of urban development. The mayor of Barcelona in the 80s and 1990s, Pascal Maragall, and then in case of Berlin, Klaus Wowereit, the nominally social democratic mayor who responsible for large state privatizations of housing and other public assets. And the third thing that these two cases have in common are these dissenting voices by architects who spoke out in their capacity as actors in urban policy and planning against mainstream forms of urban development and developed some influential theories of urban change along the way, while also consistently refused to engage with post-industrial capital at the very moment it strengthened its control over the city. And I focused on the Catalan architect and urban critic Ignasi de Solà-Morales and the Berlin collective of architects and planners called Urban Catalyst. So let's jump to the first case. So the Barcelona story, as I want to tell it, begins with the 1994 essay called Terreny Vag by Ignasi de Solà-Morales, in which he argued that there's a kind of intrinsic value to post-industrial wastelands. He used this French loanword to explore two meanings. So he says that vague or vague is on the one hand spaces that are vague, on the one hand vacant or empty, although this is a case of false etymology possibly. And on the other hand, vague, spaces that are vague are also ambiguous, indeterminate, and or marked with sort of future potential. So this essay is a kind of philosophical reading of unproductive or unintentional urban landscapes as sort of historic layers or sensors of change. And since its publication, the idea of an intrinsically valuable terrain vague has become a sort of unavoidable reference in a range of fields and disciplines: landscape design, landscape studies, urban studies. And first, the evidence I gathered from his private archives is that in the years after the essay was published in 1994, he traveled extensively around the U.S. and sort of like promoted this idea at architecture schools. In urban studies, there's often this sort of implied link between lack of intentionality revealed in my stance and a sort of socioeconomic alternative to capitalist accumulation. But what I want to suggest is that sort of this reading, both of these readings need to be sort of rethought by placing the argument in the actual historical context in which he developed it, right? So placing it in and that context is the urban transformation in Barcelona in the late 80s and early 90s, and that of his own sort of professional formation around that time. So in the 1980s, Barcelona underwent a massive transformation that started as a kind of socialist project to restore popular power through what is called reurbanizing the city after the dictatorship ended in 1975. But the effort soon capitulated to the market, marked by the Olympic bid launched in the late 1980s and an emphasis on urban image and competitiveness, which then resulted in a sort of close partnership between planning, policy, and private capital, and a series of large-scale redevelopments of former industrial and working-class neighborhoods. So most notably, this iconic Olympic Village project that was built on the site of the working-class neighborhood Poblenou. And Solà Morales was closely involved with this transformation as an architect, public intellectual, and also a consultant. So he was actually a consultant on this Olympic Village project, as he's included his son. So he told me about his involvement with this project. And so, sort of Solà Morales came from an influential family of architects. So his father, for example, was the dean of the Barcelona Architect Association. And in the 1980s, his most famous project is a reconstruction of the Miss Panderoje pavilion that was set up as a temporary pavilion in the 1930s. And then in 1983 or 4, I think, was rebuilt as a permanent structure. And Solà Morales was involved. So he was the chief architect for this reconstruction. And he was busy with this for like 3 or 4 years in the mid 80s. And then he spent time, in the US where he got in contact with Peter Eisenman and other architects who were engaged at the intersections of the avant-garde architecture and post-structuralist philosophy, started reading Deleuze and that kind of stuff. So that's a kind of background for his work. But it is Olympic Barcelona that provides an immediate context to the argument about the intrinsic value of urban wastelands. So the essay sort of, you read it, this offends how Solà Morales was really concerned with the spread of urban growth and so a kind of neo-romantic attachment to these marginal spaces, such as those photographed by his close friend Manolo Laguilo, who is also mentioned in the essay as sort of one of the inspiration for this argument. Yet, what I want to suggest is that the Tachenwald argument is premised on a sort of confused politics that was concerned more with the philosophical and formal attributes of ostensibly empty space, or even with their visual representation, rather than with the shifting political economy of urban redevelopment. So, for example, there is an implicit endorsement of the idea which was developed by this influential planner, Oriol Bohidas, this idea of esponjamiento, or sponging, right? Which is this policy promoted by Bohidas to open up dense industrial neighborhoods and sort of federating them with culture and nature. And in this context, emptiness becomes a sort of formal quality in this marriage between capital and urban design, with an emphasis on high quality design of public or open spaces, right? So it's a very different notion of emptiness. And especially revealing in this regard is Solà Morales' overall positive assessment of the Olympic interventions, which he believed, I quote, truly created public space out of residual space, end of quote, simply because they respected the 19th century grid. So Tachenwald is conceptualized as a potential, so the value is not in the actual social or physical condition of a site, but comes from a series of formal qualities inherent in the condition that the architect must grasp and express in their work, right? And he reserves the highest praise for the Olympic Village, then this master plan by Bohidas arguing that innovative architecture made there a project to complete this 19th century urban grid following the famous Herda plan with these avenues and distinctive octagonal blocks, right? At the end of the day, the irony is that the philosophical argument around the value of empty space was used here to justify the destruction of a working class urban fabric and community in Poblenou. So there's a kind of tension between a social continuity in the sense of a right to stay put and an abstract or formal continuity of a plan or of an imagined plan, right? A similar tension then moving on to 1986, but still staying in Barcelona. Similar tension played out during the 1996 meeting of the International Union of Architects meeting in Barcelona, which Sala Morales organized and hosted in this building that was actually commissioned by his father as the head of the Union of Architects. At that meeting, the Renovat was one of the main themes, one of the five main themes for the meeting. And he, in the introduction, he even begins by noting the value of the non-productive city, but instead of underlying the social dimensions of urban transformation, he kind of naturalizes wastelands as a natural byproduct of inevitable change, complete with a series of references to Deleuze and other post-structuralist philosophers. The meeting included a three-day session on Terre Renouvelable with some of the most famous or influential architects on the roster, where these people put very different kinds of ideas about what Terre Renouvelable is. And basically for them, it was a kind of opportunity to stage sort of large-scale interventions. And this was chaired by Juan Busquets, who worked as a coordinator of urban planning services for Barcelona and fostered many Olympic projects. And he gave a speech during the conference meeting where he boasted how the partnership that planners struck with private capital actually helped to redevelop the Renoir and reuse abandoned spaces as first-rate urban areas, as he put it. To conclude this part, because Sala Morales never fully confronted the capitalist or ecological dynamics underpinning ostensibly empty sites, the idea of Terre Renouvelable was premised on a narrowly formalist conception of urban change. So, and historically, what appears as a progressive argument has effectively served the process of marginalizing social justice in urban planning and design. Moving to Berlin, we can observe a similar tension at play in the work and contributions of the collective of architects and planners called Urban Catalyst. So we are in the early 2000s, when Urban Catalyst put forward a series of proposals in which they explained that the job of a planner is to function as a catalyst, which is where the name comes, as a catalyst for self-organizing change. They emphasize the significance of artists and other creative workers as what they call urban pioneers, and introduced a planning legislation they call temporary use, or Vision Nutzung, that would allow to formalize informal uses as a driver of change. So then the context is very important. Obviously, the context in this case is the conservative turn in planning in post-unification Berlin, marked by the so-called critical reconstruction approach, which encouraged a return to this sort of traditional street and block typology and was codified in the 1990 master plan. So the 1990s is also when Berlin was shrinking, and Urban Catalyst then argued that in this context, a shrinking city, instead of such massive investments, the emphasis should be on the value and formal uses. So the key figures was Philip Oswald, who was a public intellectual and activist involved in a series of other projects around the time. Perhaps most famously, he led the protest against the demolition of Palace de la République by arguing that the building already functions like the fun palace imagined by the British architect Cedric Price in the 1960s. So this is publication called Fun Palace 2006, in which they proposed that formlessness and lack of form and non-design sort of are valuable as opposed to kind of formal order, right? Which then earlier he articulated the same idea in this book from 1999 called The Formless City, written together with Antoni Fontenot. They argue that Berlin is ugly but intense, and also argue that voids are potential compete with a series of references to none other than Sola Morales in the book, but then highlighting a series of strategies for working with emptiness as a design concept. So in this chapter on voids as potential, you already see there are projects by MVRDV or OMA with their Dutch embassy, right, in Berlin. So again, sort of, there's already a tension between this image, which illustrates a void in this sort of like existing state and this sort of like architecture reading, where it's immediately transformed into kind of like formal concept. The name Urban Catalyst comes from a European Union research project that was funded for 3 years, run between 2001 to 2003. It was set up as a sort of collaboration between partners from five different cities. And the sort of the chair for this whole project was Claes Christiansen, the today famous Dutch planner who at the time had the chair of, I think, urban design at TU. This research study was a survey of informal temporary uses in Berlin and other cities, highlighting the role as wellsprings of creative economy and catalysts of urban transformation through a series of categories and classifications. Urban catalysts tie the value of voids to their potential role as quote-unquote breeding grounds for innovation. Temporary users, they argue, value personal visions more than political demands. So a key emphasis is on the link between informality and entrepreneurialism. And there's an explicit argument referring to these governance strategies that were in the early 2000s being introduced in the cities of Global South, right? With the kind of neoliberal developmentalism premised on the idea that entrepreneurship equals empowerment. And they basically argue that this kind of model should be introduced also in shrinking cities in Europe, such as Berlin. Really, what we see is a kind of naturalization of change. I'm really fascinated by this diagram from the book, where urban change is represented as a kind of weather forecast, with the creative economy being sort of portrayed as beyond power and ideology. And you see that East Berlin, the weather is the best. And the emphasis on and role of the architect as a catalyst of creative cities is marked by new forms of neoliberal governance that incorporates grassroots into the accumulation. And so even as urban catalysts challenged the neoconservative myth of political reconstruction, they were complicit with another myth, the myth of poor but sexy Berlin, pushed in the early 2000s by the nominally social democratic mayor, Klaus Wowereit. And so the rule of the social democrats in Berlin is marked in the early 2000s is marked by the rapid commodification of craft industries and creative work, along with large-scale housing privatization. But the early 2000s is also when the demographic trend is reversed from a shrink. So Berlin kind of became a growing city. And this is the context in which urban catalysts were commissioned to produce a follow-up study. They were commissioned by the Berlin Senate Department for Urban Development to do a follow-up study on a kind of comprehensive survey of more than 500 hectares of vacant space in Berlin. And this was published in 2007 as a white paper. The premise was explicitly to turn Berlin into a global creative metropolis, with the idea that temporary users generate substantial amount of financial value that can be then captured by planners and developers. So urban pioneers, this study provided a framework for operationalizing temporary use as a post-industrial urban development strategy for generating financial stimulus. And as the senator for urban development put it, this was a chance for landowners to realize the potential. So now potential becomes a financial potential, economic potential. And a series of collages weaves through the book that captured the double-edged role of the architect in integrating creative work with capitalist accumulation. So in this particularly striking double spread, photographs of DJs and the iconic palace are set against a series of newspaper clippings that juxtapose reports on creative nomads with headlines such as "The city lies empty, 800 plots are waiting for investors." Like Sola Morales, urban catalysts never fully confronted the capitalist dynamics of urban redevelopment. So the ostensibly progressive argument for a shrinking city has effectively transformed into a tool for gentrification, a process which then took off in Berlin in the mid-2000s. And so in this narrow instrumentalizing view, the value that arts and culture add to neighborhoods isn't allowed to be appropriated by real estate capital, leading to the marginalization of social justice. To conclude, I want to bring up an argument from this fantastic book by art historian Daniela Sandler. If you haven't read it, I definitely recommend you to do it, in which he introduces the concept of counter-preservation as a way for understanding the intentional appropriation of decrepitude that has marked the aesthetic of gentrification and post-unification Berlin. Sandler also talks about the appropriation of decay as design. Yet what manifests most conspicuously as kind of juxtaposition of crumbling facades or walls with luxurious interiors is much more than simply a matter of aesthetic or architecture. As urban historian Rebecca Amato reminds us, Tek en Vague and other notions of urban emptiness risk reproducing the very colonial and capitalist imaginaries they seek to challenge. And along the same lines, geographer Neil Smith wrote that the idea of urban pioneers is as insulting as the idea of the original pioneers in the West. Now, as then, it implies that no one lives in the areas being pioneered, no one worthy of notice, at least. So what the two episodes from Barcelona and Berlin reveal is a tension between developing a heightened attention to the texture or dynamics of ostensibly empty marginal places and reinserting to these places into the cycle of capitalist accumulation. More specifically, situating the idea of terre en vague and temporary uses in the specific place and time in which they were developed reveals how the architect, critic, or urban expert remained complicit with post-industrial capital even as they came to appreciate the aesthetic or former qualities of post-industrial wastelands. And while these are histories of neoliberal urbanism, more specifically, they are also histories of silence or of silencing or marginalizing inequity and injustice concern as part of nominally progressive urban interventions. Thank you very much.
Thanks to you for listening.
For more information, visit our website urbanpolitical.podigee.io.